Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Hello, again, this is Elisa Montali from the National Quality Forum, and I'd like to welcome you to this conference call for the National Voluntary Consensus Standards for Ambulatory Care. Also with me from NQF are my colleagues Daryl Conyers and Jessica Weber and Karen Pace, and I think Helen Bernstein is also on the call.
She just joined.
Oh, hi, Helen. Before I hand over the call to your co-chairs, there are a couple of items I just wanted to bring to your attention. As you already know, this is an open session. It's open to NQF members and to the public, and there'll be an opportunity at the end of the call for members and public to provide comments. Measure developers are also participating and are available to answer questions on any points of clarity that you may have. And as you know, also, we are taping the session, and so we ask that before making any comment that you please state your name, and we'll be posting the recording on the NQF website within the next 2 to 3 weeks. And so just before I turn it over to your co-chairs, I just wanted to let you know that this is a follow-up to the in-person meeting that took place on April 6th and 7th, in which the committee reviewed measures and brought forth recommendations for endorsement. Several measures were recommended for endorsement with conditions or are pending a decision. And we asked measure developers to provide additional information to assist the committee in their decision-making process. The measure developers did respond to the committee's request, so the committee will discuss those measures today. In accordance with NQF's consensus development process, voting cannot take place during this conference call. So the steering committee will record their vote via an online survey following today's session. And so I will hand it over to Dr. Moorhead and Ms. Stone Griffith, who will lead the committee in introductions. And I'll ask that while you're doing that, if you could please state if there are any updates to the disclosures of interest statements that you gave all of us during the April 6th and 7th meeting. So Dr. Moorhead and Ms. Stone Griffith.
Go ahead, John.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you, everyone, for your time, not only in Washington, but in preparation for this meeting. You have a lot of information that's been sent to you. I hope everyone's been able to figure it out. It's a little complicated, and I just wanted to check with Elisa to make sure that everyone had the right information in front of them. Should we have the go to meetings? Is that what we should have, as well as open the or print it off the documents you sent us, Elisa? Is that what we should go from?
Yes. If you could go to GoToMeeting, that's the most up to date. What it has that you got that you don't have in the packet that you received on Friday is the first two pages, which are the standards that you recommended without condition. And I'll just spend a couple of minutes going over that, but you have essentially everything in the packet that was sent to you on Friday. So if you can't pull up the web document, that's fine. You can refer to the email that I sent.
Is there anyone having any technical problems? Okay. Well, thank you. We look forward to working our way through this. It is a fair amount of material, but I think if you'll bear with us, we can get through this in a couple hours, so look forward to a productive meeting. Suzanne, any comments?
No, I think that was terrific. I will say that with the update of the measure from Optimal, the same document, Elisa, was sent twice, and just make sure you have the most recent because they really do look identical. I noticed that.
Okay.
And that one came out this morning, correct, Elisa?
Yes, and actually what that was, I think it was the head CT scan interpretation. We sent the primary and secondary reviewers the entire reconsideration request from Optimal Solutions, and we also copied the co-chairs. But that information will be in the table on page 18. Unfortunately, the only change I didn't mention before is that underneath the steering committee's conditions on page 18, we erroneously copied an ENT condition, and so what you have to refer to is what's on the screen. That is the condition that the steering committee made for the head CT scan.
Well, I think as we go through each of these measures, we'll make sure everyone has the correct information in front of them. And as we go through today, I think the logical way to do this would be to ask the primary and secondary reviewer of each of the measures that we're going to discuss to lead the discussion for that measure. Lisa, do we need a roll call?
Yes, we do. And so we can start with you and Suzanne. We know you're both here. So can you hand me down? Okay. Dr. Allison Drini, we know you're here as well.
Yes.
Dr. Chilean, are you on the call? Dr. Cohen? Dr. Beverly Collins, I think you're here as well.
Yes, nothing else to disclose as well.
Okay. Dr. Jeffrey Collins?
Here.
Thank you. Dr. Eisenberg?
Here.
Thank you. Dr. Jouse?
Here.
Thank you. Ms. McCartney?
Here.
Thank you. Dr. Newman?
Here.
Thank you. Dr. O'Connor?
Present.
Thank you. Dr. Roberts? And I, just to let you know, Dr. Roberts did send me an email just a couple of minutes ago. She's suffering from the flu. She wasn't sure she'd be able to make it. Dr. Saltzman? And Suzanne Stone Griffith?
Yes, here. Here.
Dr. Adams?
Here.
And Ms. Altares?
Here.
Okay, great.
Thank
you. So we do have a quorum, and so we can continue.
All right, thank you. So I think what we need here is just to ask everyone on the call if they have any additional disclosures for this call. You've already done them at the meeting. I guess we're looking for anything new.
No.
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 All right.
No.
Not hearing any, we can move on to our agenda, and we're going to begin with measures that we've recommended for endorsement. Alisa?
Yes. The committee reviewed 27 measures. 10 were not recommended for endorsement. 9 were recommended with conditions or pending a decision, and 8 were recommended for time-limited endorsement without conditions. And those include the measures that you see on the screen. The first one is an ultrasound determination of pregnancy location for pregnant patients with abdominal pain. The measure steward is the American College of Emergency Physicians. This measure was recommended for time-limited endorsement. The second measure is also from the American College of Emergency Physicians, and this is Rogam for Rh-negative pregnant women at risk of fetal blood exposure, and this is also recommended for time-limited endorsement. The next three measures are recommended as a paired measure. I'm sorry?
Could we just pause for a second? You said they're on the screen. Let's just make sure everyone, when you say on the screen, where are you referring to?
I'm referring to the table. Do you see a table on the screen? The title, it says the National Quality Forum, and one of the subtitles is the Candidate Standards Recommended for Endorsement Without Conditions.
The page one is Candidate Standards Recommended for Endorsement with Conditions. So which page do we need to go to?
Okay. This is the updated. This is just part of the presentation. This is going through. We will go through those measures after these first two pages. These are the measures that you recommended without condition.
Lisa, this is Karen. I think the issue is that not everyone is on the webinar, so you also need to orient them to what documents you're in.
Okay. Did everyone sign into the webinar? It looks like you did. So just make sure that you didn't pull up the document that I forwarded to you by email. And that is different than the presentation document that we're using right now. Okay.
What's the address for the webinar?
It is https://www.gotomeeting.com/register/3215-05440.
Was that sent to us?
Yes, that's in the agenda. It's at the top of the agenda.
Okay.
So what I can do is go through this list, and the next on page 3 is where we will probably be on the same page with regards to the information I sent you on Friday.
So, Alyssa, just to review, what you initially read off are those candidate standards recommended for endorsement without conditions.
Right, right. These are not the measures that you will be discussing today. It's just an FYI so that it's on record and everyone knows what you recommended during the April 6th and 7th meeting. So the third measure is from the American Medical Association. There are three measures that were recommended for time-limited endorsement as a paired measure. And the first one is an otitis media with infusion. This is antihistamines or decongestants, avoidance of inappropriate use. The second measure is an otitis media with infusion, systematic corticosteroids, avoidance of inappropriate use. And the third measure is also an otitis media with infusion, systematic antimicrobials, avoidance of inappropriate use. Again, these were recommended as a paired measure for time-limited endorsement. And the final three measures are also from the American Medical Association. They are endoscopy measures. They are concentrating on polyp surveillance. The first one is appropriate follow-up interval of normal colonoscopy in average-risk patients. The second one is colonoscopy interval for patients for history of adenomatitis, polyps, avoidance of inappropriate use. And the third one is comprehensive colonoscopy documentation. Again, these three measures were recommended for time-limited endorsement. And so now we will turn to page 3, and this mirrors the information that you received on Friday. The title of these measures are the candidate standards that are recommended for endorsement with conditions. And so you have asked measure developers to respond to some of the concerns that you had in your review. So I will turn it over to Dr. Moorhead and Ms. Stone Griffith.
Thanks, Alyssa. So I think on the GoToMeeting in our document, we're on page 1 to get everyone oriented, and so we'll begin with a discussion of measure number 9 with otitis externa topical therapy. And Era, are you on the call yet? Era is not on the call. So, Jeff, were you able to review this?
Yes.
Could you just give us your impressions of the feedback that we've received and any recommendations?
I thought their corrections addressed what we were interested in, and so it it made it more likely for the group to accept it with the changes.
Okay. Does anyone else have any comments about this particular? I would agree. The exclusions were okay, and So, Jeff, would your recommendation at this point would be?
To accept the way it is now as a joint.
Recommend this going as a combined measure with number 10, I think it was. Wasn't
right,
that?
Right.
Number 11.
Number 11.
11, yeah.
Sorry, number 11. All right. So can we take that as a motion? Oh, we're not voting then, right? We're just going to discuss this, and then the vote will be on the...
We'll be on email for you,
yeah.
Is it helpful to have any discussion about any... Well, we want to go through anyone's concern. I guess we'll wait, and then everyone will vote on the after the meeting.
Right, but this is, and this is Helen. This would be a good opportunity to have the committee address any concerns they have with the measure developers' responses. But we'll summarize that, send it out to the email to the entire committee as well. So if anybody missed the call, they'll hear your discussion as well.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
So given that discussion, the recommendation is to recommend endorsement of 9 as a paired measure with 11. Any further discussion, any concerns with that?
No.
Well, so I guess we can go ahead and talk about number 11 as well. So this was...
That was me also.
Okay.
And again, if it's paired with number 9, I don't have any... I thought they did a nice job of addressing our concerns.
So I have on number 11, I had Eva, were you on that one?
On 11?
Evie, yeah.
I'm having a hard time navigating between my documents and the webinar. I don't know if anybody else is having that issue.
So this is acute otitis externa, systemic antibiotic therapy.
Yeah, I think I was on that one, wasn't I, Elisa?
Yes, you and Dr. Newman.
Right. And this one, I think, was the one that had less concerns. I thought we were fine with this one.
I agree. That was my recollection as well.
Right, and so I reading through what the measure developer has written seems adequate and consistent with our discussion.
Nathan, did you have any other comments? All right, so your recommendation on 11 then, Evie, is to recommend endorsement?
Yes, I think we can recommend endorsement as written here.
Comments or concerns by any of the committee members? All right, we move to number...
Sorry, I agree with that. We had some initial discussion. I had to mute on. We had some initial discussion about the exclusions and a potential exhaustive list, but I think that they answered that pretty well. They seem to satisfy the specific and categorization of the measured exclusions with critical functions, and they did a good job.
Okay, so the motion the sense I'm hearing is for endorsement. We now move to number 23. Everyone can get there. That is on page 4 of the GoToMeetings. Time to pain management. It's been for long bone fractures. That's been changed to Optimal Solutions Group. So, number 23. Actually, I don't have the primary listed there.
Yes, Dr. Cohen.
Alyssa, could you call out who was the primary and secondary reviewer? That might help everybody.
This one only had one reviewer. The primary was Victor Cohen, and he's not on the call today.
Okay.
So this was changed. The way I read this is this was changed to maybe the measure developers there on the call could give us a summary of their response. It looks like we're dividing this into two separate measures.
Yeah, so this is Dale Bratzler. I'm representing the Optimal Solutions Group for this measure today, and I met with you at the previous meeting. So let me just reflect on what the committee recommended for changes when we last met. The first was to expand the age range to include all age groups, not limited to those 18 and over. The second recommendation that came out of this ambulatory steering committee was to include other pain medication modalities or pain modalities such as regional anesthesia techniques as an appropriate form of pain management. And then the third was to remove patients with contraindications to pain medication from the denominator exclusion. So let me just quickly say the two of those are easy, and we have done those. The first was we did include in our appendix of tables for pain management those regional anesthesia techniques, blocks, beer blocks, and others that might be used in an emergency department. So those were included. And we did remove the contraindication to pain medication from the denominator. Where we differed a bit from what the committee recommended was after a lengthy conversation with representatives from CMS, including Dr. Rapp. Many of you know Dr. Rapp, who also is an emergency physician. He had some difficulty with the concept of having an all-age group performance measure on pain management for long bone fractures, and at the very least recommended that we consider an age range that went from, say, 2 years and above. The second thing that was discussed by the committee that we discussed fairly at great length was whether or not the pain management modalities should include oral medications. Now, most of us didn't have a lot of pediatric expertise, and so we felt that there were some pediatric patients who might have long bone fractures where oral management might be appropriate and, in fact, might be done fairly routinely for some of those patients. So Dr. Rapp and the team we met discussed it. We felt that rather than submitting a single measure, that we should submit two different measures, one for patients 18 and over and one for patients ages 2 to 17. In the 2 to 17 group, essentially the measure is just as we discussed in our previous conversations. We removed the exclusion for contraindications. We included the other pain modalities, but we left the tables that included oral medications for pain management since using ICD-9 codes to define a denominator population, I'm afraid, doesn't let you say much about the severity of the fracture. For the adult measure, however, we decided after discussing with Dr. Rapp, he really did not want to leave oral pain medications as a modality in the adult measure. And so we went through the ICD-9 codes, and as best we could, we limited the denominator for the adult measure to patients with mid-shaft type fractures of the humerus, the femur, or the tibia, just those three bones. I'm afraid, you know, ICD-9 coding simply doesn't give you a great deal of latitude about determining the severity or deformity or the other things that were discussed by the committee. In the future, ICD-10 actually does give you a great deal of extra specificity, but at least based on the current technique that we had to use, ICD-9, we decided for the adult measure to limit to mid-shaft, tibia, femur, and humerus fractures in the adults with only parenteral or regional pain management as the acceptable modalities. Again, we would be open to conversation by the committee around the pediatric age group, again, because ICD-9 coding doesn't let you differentiate things like deformity, and because we were really trying to avoid another chart-abstracted data element around deformity, we kept the denominators the same for the childhood measure 2 to 17, but included oral pain medication, parenteral or regional anesthesia techniques. Finally, I think the last thing, I don't know if it's got on our list, but as discussed by the committee, Dr. Rapp felt that it would be more prudent if we used a defined time limit for identification of numerator population. In other words, what proportion of the patients received pain management within, I believe for this one, wasn't it 30 minutes?
Right.
30 minutes of arrival. And, of course, arrival time is a data element that we've had for a long time, and it's well-defined. So to report it as a proportion rather than a median. I think that summarizes our discussions. And, again, we were very open to the conversation about the second measure, the 2 to 17 age group, and I know there was pediatric expertise on your committee.
Thank you for summarizing that. I guess there's a couple of points that the committee needs to consider. The first, maybe I can ask Evie to get out of the way. Is it acceptable, Evie, to leave out the under twos? That seemed to be a pretty good argument.
Yeah, I think that there are certainly well-validated pain scales, for children of all ages. And so I think that, from the perspective of, identifying pain that's not really too much of an issue, I think it is not acceptable to think that children would benefit from oral pain medication when adults would require other modalities of pain management, and that we certainly have documented disparities in care across ages that I don't think that we would want to promote in this setting. I think that I do really agree with what you say, because certainly management of a distal radial buckle fracture, or a Salter-Harris 1 fracture, which, as you mentioned, cannot be currently identified accurately using ICD-9 codes, would not necessarily require some type of parenteral medication. But I think for consistency's sake, there would be no reason to suggest that you couldn't have the same denominator inclusions and exclusions in a pediatric population versus an adult population, and think about, as you had mentioned, femur, humerus, tibia, things as such. But I'd be interested in hearing what the rest of the committee had to say, but I think at this point in time, for matters of equity and patient-centeredness, that we would, not consider oral pain medications adequate for pediatric patients if they weren't for adults.
And I think we were certainly open to that conversation. We spent a lot of time going through ICD-9 codes, and
yes,
I think that was our biggest concern. Was I know that you had discussed earlier about using deformity as one of the denominator inclusions, and that requires chart review then.
Yeah.
So we were able to go through and at least look at the mid-shaft fractures and limited to three bones. And we can make the same, change
to
the appendix.
Did you have that discussion, and that seems something that would be amenable to your group in terms of, using those same criteria for the pediatric patients?
Yes, I think so.
I mean, we see a lot of, radius ulna, both bone fractures, and maybe that could be another way to add those to your denominator. If it's both ulna and radius, it's probably something that's more severe and would require parenteral therapy. But I would recommend, using the same denominator inclusions and then cut it down to two.
Are there comments from other members of the committee?
Yeah, this is Andy. I'm just wondering, I mean, I see people all the time with complaining of 9 or 10 out of 10 excruciating pain from, you know, trauma, et cetera, that wind up not having a fracture whatsoever, and others with fractures that come in all age groups that, you know, had a girl the other day, a little 4-year-old, with an obvious deformity and actually multiple radius and ulna fractures, who was just sitting there playing quietly. So it's a little hard to, I'm not sure I can categorize it as easily as we're trying to. I mean, I understand the discussion on the age ratings, but pain is such a subjective thing, too, that makes it difficult.
But Andy, probably that child would, and this is Evie Allison Drady, would probably require some type of splinting or manipulation that would be painful when they're immobilized. It wasn't a big deal, right? So you would probably, you know, want to engage them in some type of pain management, particularly based upon the therapy that they would require.
Well, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, this particular facility, we have no orthopedics, so it was one of those that we were kind of stuck with, well, what are we doing now? And it was going to be a transfer kind of thing. So the 30-minute window would then be the issue, that if she's comfortable right then and all you're doing is putting a splint around it, then maybe you don't necessarily need medicine. I mean, that's probably the exception. But, I mean, I'm okay with the way you've presented it and the changes that have been presented, and just the subjective nature of pain that we get people all the time with, you know, excruciating them in 9, 10 out of 10 pain. You try to get in there, you give them medication, they have no fracture. And others, again, that may have fractures and other factors that are involved, and then the 30-minute issue kind of comes into account. But I think I'm okay with the changes that have been proposed and the way it's worded.
Other thoughts from the group? What I'm hearing is we keep this as one measure, so it would be a measure for those over 2 years of age?
I think that would be good.
With changes to limit this to, there's only two bones we're comparing at this point?
We did humerus, tibia, and femur was what we ended up. Because the ICD-9 codes for radius and ulna, there are so many different fractures there, many of them we felt were relatively minor. Now, I don't think we looked at combined radius and ulnar fractures, but we decided to stick with the long bones, tibia, femur, and humerus for the denominator.
Thank you. So it would be, and we're not, at least at this point, I'm hearing the recommendation not to leave in the PO, but it would be parenteral analgesia within 30 minutes for those three bones for patients above the ages of 2. Are there other comments from the committee?
No.
John, this is Suzanne. What about the proposal on the stratification of time to medication? Because that was included as well. I didn't hear yay or nay on that.
So I think originally we had presented this as a median time to pain medication.
Right.
And quite a few had suggested that we needed to either stratify or show some metrics beyond just the central tendency. And after discussions with CMS, the feeling was that in terms of consumer usefulness, having proportions was more useful. So we chose 30 minutes, albeit a bit arbitrary, but that's the time frame that we chose, and I suppose that can be up for discussion.
This is 30 minutes from time of arrival?
Yes.
I think that's probably worth some consideration, just given the practicalities of seeing patients and all of these patients and getting some kind of diagnosis, but I don't know. That's a good point. So currently it would be the proportion who receive parenteral analgesia within 30 minutes from time of arrival. Is that correct?
That's correct. Parenteral or some regional technique.
Right. So, thoughts from the committee? That's a sort of number picked out of the air. Is that too short? 60 minutes better? 30 minutes okay?
So, John, this is Evie Allison Dream. This is a big improvement initiative that's been going on over the last 18 months or so at Cincinnati Children's. And we did some polling of parents, you know, about what they thought was a reasonable time period, and they said, of course, immediately. So when we actually looked at our data and what seemed achievable, our current target is 45 minutes. So it's the proportion of patients that get their analgesic IV. Now, we have the ability to look at deformed fractures, but within 45 minutes. So 30 minutes, despite our best efforts, was really hard to achieve in a significant proportion of patients. We realized that we really wanted it to be less than an hour, sitting from, you know, the patient side of things. And so, again, it's sort of like that arbitrary thing, but what we've been working on for the last year is 45 minutes, and it seems to be working pretty well. We're making some headway and have gotten about 75% of our kids' IV pain medications in that time with changing certain processes of care.
That just sort of has a gut feel a little better than 30 to me and still keeps us under an hour. So what do people think of that suggestion, maybe 45? Would the developers be okay with that?
Yes, we would.
This is Jim Adams. I have a question, I suppose. Most of the x-rays are not done within that time frame, so this means the pain medicine needs to precede the x-ray result?
Yeah, Jim, that's a really good point. One is we do, you know, again, we talked about our denominator being different, so we are giving IV pain medications to people with deformities, but we've changed the system so that the film can actually be done in that time period too. But we are not withholding pain medication waiting for films.
Jim.
Yeah, along the same lines as what Jim just said, this is Bob O'Connor. You know, given the definitions in terms of which bones are fractured, there's a tremendous variation in what type of fracture is present, how much pain the patient's in, as well as how obvious the deformity may be. You know, if it's a younger patient with an obvious humerus fracture, you know it's deformed. The diagnosis of fracture is evident without an x-ray, but some of the other films, I'm sort of struggling with if someone who's not in pain, who doesn't obviously have a fracture until the radiographs of pain, and then it's kind of surprising. And I'm not sure that those patients really require the same degree of attentiveness for analgesics as someone who comes in, obviously in exquisite pain with an obviously traumatically deformed extremity.
And it sounds like we don't get that level of definition until we go to ICD-10. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a whole lot more specificity in ICD-10, which does define lots of displacement, fracture, deformity, and other things. So we actually did do the crosswalk. ICD-9 at this point just simply didn't give us enough specificity.
Bob, do you think that's O'Connor? Do you think that's enough of a concern to delay recommending this?
Yeah, I personally do because I fear the unintended consequences of this. And that there are some fractures that are enormously difficult to identify, and patients seem to tolerate fairly well.
There's one other way to potentially address this, and that would be to leave the decision about use of the analgesic in the hands of the emergency department physician, but keep in the denominator those patients that got some. So, in other words, if the clinician elected not to give the analgesic, then the case wouldn't be in the denominator.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd only report those that actually were treated.
And that's for all ages from 2 on up?
Well, if we're going to do one major, we'd have to do it the same.
patients' analgesic requirements vary with time. It's not really a snapshot where, I think of people who come in who aren't that uncomfortable, but as their course of care progresses, they require a parenteral analgesic. Perhaps they're going to the operating room and oral meds are contraindicated. I'm sort of struggling with whether we link this to a pain scale or specific types of fractures that we know are more dramatic in their presentation, more obvious.
I think that's what, this is Evie. I think that that's what the measure developers really worked hard to do. And I guess if we all put ourselves in being one of those patients with a humerus or a femur or tibia fracture, I would want IV pain medication.
Yeah, so would we want to specify mid-shaft fracture as opposed to a fractured surgical neck of the humerus or, an avulsion fracture from somewhere? I mean, just to have a definition, because I clearly agree that a mid-shaft fracture of either of those bones requires, pain medication as soon as possible.
So we would welcome anybody to look through the list. We actually did try to do that. We tried to pick shaft fractures and get rid of the epiphyseal and the avulsions and the others. I won't guarantee that we got rid of every one that we shouldn't have in the list, but that's what we specifically tried to do was, since we were limiting to parenteral or regional anesthesia, we felt that we should look at the ICD-9 coding as best we could to identify those fractures that were long bone, big bone, not just the peripheral, the ends, and those types of things.
I think that's a valiant effort. It's Evie Alastrini again, and I think that I guess the other discussion is while we always strive to be perfect, it could be that the target of the proportion of patients to get that treatment within 30 or 45 minutes doesn't necessarily need to be 100%, but realizing that as we improve our diagnostic coding accuracy and things like that, that getting that done, 70 or 80% of the time is pretty good. Or, whatever the baseline data shows and the degree of improvement that, needs to occur over time. I don't know if that's a consideration.
I mean, if we just called the mid-shaft fractures of either of the three bones, I would be absolutely supportive of 30 minutes. Those patients are in exquisite pain, and that is the humane way to go. I just worry about some of the other ones that were just mentioned, avulsions and whatnot.
So this is Jim, and I obviously completely agree with the aggressive and very speedy treatment for the patients that are in pain. But what will end up happening is we'll do this with some protocol. So if a person comes in, while we put the x-ray order in, we're going to put the narcotic order in, probably as we should, which may lead to over-treatment. Now, there has been criticism of emergency departments for aggressive over-treatment, and we're going to really be subjected to a lot of scrutiny with that, because it's not going to be people with long bone fractures. It's going to be patients who have any possibility whatsoever of a long bone fracture. Because to get it in 30 or 45 minutes, it's the presumption that there could even be a long bone fracture. So everybody will get treated like that.
Well, the other alternative I heard was to just, the denominator would be everyone who was treated, and the numerator would be those treated within time period, 45 minutes. So that would be just excluding this to the patients who received.
Right, but then what would happen is if they did have a long bone fracture, then we would we'd have places that wouldn't give IV pain medicine at all because they had a long bone fracture, and if I give it now, they're going to be included in the score.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Well,
I agree.
Good point.
There are unintended consequences of every possible performance measure, and I don't think most EDs are going to withhold treatment.
Oh, sure they will. Absolutely they will. Absolutely. If it ruins your score and it's publicly reportable, absolutely they will.
I have a problem with that.
Yeah, no, there. You should. We can have a conversation about some other unintended consequences.
I've spent half of my life around performance measurement. I know all about all the unintended consequences, but most ED docs are out there trying to do the right thing, I think.
Yeah, but it will happen. They'll give PO meds or they'll give some other treatment to keep it out of the denominator.
Well, I'm hearing that people would like to move something in this measure, and I think, Evie, clearly we want to support something in this way, but a lot of concern about some of the specifics here. Until we get to ICD-10, the better coding. So
I'm definitely in favor of doing something. I just don't know how to phrase
so
it.
So I guess the pushback I'm hearing now is about the fixed time frame. I mean, we could go back to reporting the median time and central tendency and then...
With a range. And just put the range in there, too, and that's perfect.
Then you don't have. Then you know. Then you're not forced to do something faster than you want to.
Yeah, but if we. Sorry, go ahead.
I think that if you reported medians with the range, that would be perfect because then we would get an idea of the variability.
Yeah, medians as well as a percent within the 30-minute time frame. Yeah, I still think this is an excellent measure. But if I can make a suggestion to the group, what we're really talking about, given the past couple of comments, are someone who is brought in with obvious painful deformity of an extremity after a traumatic injury, and if they have a mid-shaft fracture of any of those three bones, they ought to get an IV and parenteral pain meds before anything else really gets done other than ordering the film. So I would have no problem, subjecting any emergency department or emergency physician to a 30-minute window for that, because that would encourage the behavior we're looking for. It's just sort of the fuzzier cases that aren't so clear that give me great trouble. As far as withholding pain medication, I don't think that would deliberately happen, but it may cause someone to think twice, which we don't want someone thinking twice about this. It should be automatic. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I agree with you, Bob.
So you would like to go back to the original concept of reporting this with a median and ranges,
yes,
rather than a time period. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Any comments?
Yeah, and I'm fine with... Yeah, I think both would be fine. That's just my opinion, but I think the definition is still problematic unless we tighten that up a little bit.
I think clearly, if we had better coding, people would be right there, but we're not quite, don't have that specificity of coding. So I don't know. In terms of public usefulness, does that give it to us? I don't know. So I guess what I'm hearing on the table is one measure, reporting, and we're limiting this to parenteral analgesia for the three bones, humerus, tib, femur, reporting a median time with ranges. Am I accurate in...
This is Ed Jauch. I have a question, and all of us that have discussed this so far kind of work in a polytrauma center, in level one trauma centers, and I frequently get a person who's been, we get a lot of pedestrians and bicyclists hit by cars where their tibia is the least of my worries, and I'm busy doing other issues with them in terms of the resuscitation. Is there a consideration for how you extract or remove those patients where other life-threatening injuries, including hypotension, may supersede the need for providing analgesia?
I think there were exclusion criteria for, is that not correct?
Well, there were, but those were removed. But again, right now, as it stands, if the patient gets no pain medication, you can't calculate a time frame. If you do report medians, if the clinician for some reason decides not to give medication, you can't calculate a time, so the patient would not be in the denominator.
Well, I mean, a lot of times the patients may down the road get it, so it almost looked like a delayed administration, and I may have four or five different injuries with multiple rib fractures or this and that that would require analgesia. You know, IV, you know, you're not going to give any of these patients PO. So you may have, as part of your list of injuries, a tibia or a long bone fracture, and so then they would appear in this metric, which would be, it's probably not be the intent of this measure to look at that, but the patient would inadvertently be captured. I'm in agreement that I think it's a good measure. I'm just worried in terms of its implementation.
This is Suzanne. I asked the question about the 30 minutes because, I mean, I just have a number of issues with the measure. It seems like we're trying to work our way into a measurement construct to know whether we're really doing a good job with pain med. And when we started with the measure, it was a little bit broader and more inclusive. And at the end of the day, you know, from a patient's perspective, that's what is monumentally important to them or their family member when they're brought in. And it is sort of based on that level of pain and intensity of services that we're providing for them at the time. The more we talk about it, the more uncomfortable I am feeling with this measure, because I think we're not really getting to what the original intent was, which is how effective are we really at managing people's pain where pain is a real problem for them. And I'd rather see a measure that really goes after that we can get behind rather than try and carve it out, you know, half a dozen ways that really is not going to get to what we're trying to measure.
Dale, I want to make one more comment I wasn't aware of, but so in the data element, so I know there's been a lot of conversation here about what about the circumstances where you aren't comfortable giving the pain medicine. So I actually didn't realize it, but in the data element pain medication, which essentially defines that the patient got one, the notes for abstraction specifically state that if there is physician or PA documentation of a reason for not administering the pain medication, patient unconscious, decreased respiratory rate, refusal, then select no, and the case is not in the denominator. So it does allow for that physician documentation that it wasn't indicated or that they couldn't do it.
Well, what about going back to Bob and Jim? What about going back to, I mean, could there be a criterion there for the physician to just say not required, you know, or something for these? Your concern was somehow including cases that really wouldn't, in most practices, qualify for parenteral analgesia. There could be an exclusion as part of this physician to just exclude them, and that you know, there was some criteria, not appropriate, not needed, something where it wasn't given, and that would then not include them in the denominator.
Yeah, and that was my point. I think that actually is addressed in the data element on pain medication. It allows the physician to document the reason for not administering.
Doesn't that require a chart abstraction then? So I'm just trying to figure out the ways to, you know, if this is a balance of a chart abstraction measure versus one that can be used more readily through electronic health record data, so that if you needed to, you know, abstract some type of an exclusion criteria, that you would, what would be the added difficulty of understanding the deformity? Just to put, you know what I mean?
You know, these measures are being built for consideration for electronic health records. So if there's a field that can be documented from, it potentially could be done that way.
But I think in reality, at the current time, this is going to require a chart abstraction.
agree with that.
I think we can see where we want to go. I just don't know whether we're there yet or not.
You know, and this is Jim Adams. This is, in some cases, I would say perfection is the enemy of the good. We want to promote the proper use and timely use of the IV pain medicines. You know, I would worry that the exclusions may allow everybody to opt out, and if they didn't meet the time standard, then put it in an excuse. And so I worry that it could lead that direction too. On the other hand, it may be worth just getting a measure out there that points people in the right direction and that can be then trialed and optimized further. So I would be good with having some kind of measure.
And this is Helen, just to point out, I believe this measure would only be up for time-limited endorsement so that it actually would be tested and brought back to NQF in a relatively short time frame to learn more.
Right. So that's recognizing that, trying it as you just described with the exclusions requiring chart abstraction, maybe it's worth the effort.
Of course, the other thing I think all of you are aware of, the measure can't be used for payment accountability by CMS until it's been in the public domain for at least a year per the Patient Affordable Care Act. So it does require at least a year of public accountability before it can be used to any payment purposes.
Abby, is this okay? Is this consistent then with what you're doing?
From our measurement development for pediatrics.
Right.
Yeah, I mean we have looked in choosing the measures here. We chose an outcome measure, and we looked specifically at a specified denominator, patients with long bone fractures, and then our. And we actually are looking at changes in pain scores. So we were trying to look at something, again, more outcomes-oriented and patient-centered. And so we're looking specifically at those children who had a reduction in their pain score over 60 minutes. So I agree with Jim. We don't want the, you know, perfection to be the enemy of the good. And I do think we should get something out there. And I kind of feel like if we looked at patients over 2 and limited to these mid-shaft long bone fractures, where I think most of us agree that they need IV pain medication, that at least documenting that it was given, and then, you know, secondarily looking at a time frame is really relevant and a direction I think that we should head in, because we all know that pain management, adequate pain management, is so tied to satisfaction with your ED care. I think it's the right way to go. I don't know, is there some type of a balancing measure that we could be looking at that would help us to understand if there were significant gaming that were occurring? I imagine you could get people to look at trends of these, you know, fractures over time, and if the number of diagnoses overall were, similar, but the proportion that were eligible for the measure was shrinking, I'm not sure if there's any precedent for that, Helen.
Yeah, it's Bob here. The only gaming I can think of is, or not even gaming, just a problem is if the dose is not sufficient. I like the linking it with some sort of analog or some sort of a pain scoring and resolution thereof. But that I think can wait till after the pilot.
Yeah, this one's tested and.
And, again, I think you'll potentially learn much more when it's actually tested.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm hearing proposed time recommended for time-limited endorsement, a single measure for patients above the age of 2 with fractures, humerus, tibia, femur, parenteral analgesia, and we're back, I think, to median with ranges. Is that what I'm hearing the group support? Suzanne, are you okay with this, or you had some concerns?
I mean, I hear the discussion. I mean, I still have some concern about this. I guess
Sandy,
I would feel better.
Live with it while we're waiting for ICD-10 so that we could really expand
right.
the denominator to the more relevant group of patients that we're interested in
right.
You know, affecting.
Right. I am very concerned with the burden with the chart abstraction because I think to remove any of the exclusions, you'd have to look at that. And I would like to see, you know, some sort of patient scoring in there. I concur with that. But, again, you're going to be back into the abstraction if you do that. It will get it out there. I agree that at least we will sort of dip our toe in the water and begin to get something on pain management. I still have some concerns, though.
Are there any other points by any other committee members? I think we're probably about as far as we can get with this discussion, and we'll put that there, and people will get a chance to vote, and we'll see where it goes. Any further comments about this measure, this proposal? Thanks for all the input. Let's move ahead to number 32. So patients 2 years of age or older with acute otitis externa who were not prescribed systemic antimicrobial therapy. Let's see, this was
Dr. Allison Drini and I think Dr. Newman.
Thank you.
So I was just looking at the response from the measure developer, and I don't think that that there were any issues in terms of, it seems like our recommendations in terms of expanding the age range was not disputed, including other, oh, do we have a mistake here?
This is
Keish. I'm looking at, Lisa, it looks like on my document from 032-10, there's steering committee recommendations that look like they're pain-oriented as opposed to systemic antimicrobial therapy-oriented. Is anybody else seeing that?
Yes, I'm seeing it on the go-to-meetings one anyway.
I was looking specifically at my document because I wanted to go back and look at my own notes. So it looks like the comments are from a different measure.
Yeah, I think it is. Sorry about that. We're going to pull out the measure, the meeting summary, to get the exact comments.
Okay.
In the meantime, I believe Kay Schwepke is on the call, who's the measure developer, if she wants to just respond to the specific issue around the name change, if that's a particular issue.
Yeah.
To talk about.
Yeah, thanks, Helen. This is Kay. What I'm actually looking at on WebEx, it looks like the information on the steering committee conditions is the incorrect portion, but the response from measure developer section on the lower half of what you're seeing in the webinar is exactly what I'll describe, is we were asked to change the measure name to an affirmative statement, and we absolutely could do that to the following patients 2 years of age and older with acute otitis externa who were prescribed systemic antimicrobial therapy. Our only concern, and I just wanted to point this out to the committee, was that by phrasing it in this way, it may give the impression that systemic antibiotics are actually recommended in the treatment of this condition, and that's certainly not the intent of the measure, and we want to make sure that a name change doesn't cause some confusion.
And this is Evie Allison Drini. I understand those concerns, and I'm not particularly concerned if the name were not changed that it would be deleterious to the measure or the process.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree.
So you're recommending we go back to the original name of the proposal, which is not prescribed?
I think that the measure developers bring up a really important question with respect to overuse, and so that would be fine with me, and I'm happy to be the recommender of that. Thank you. I'll be the schizophrenic one, but that's fine.
On further review, I really agree. And this being one of the few national clinical guidelines, it really addresses the management of acute otitis externa with the measures we've reviewed. I think it's a good point to leave it in the not prescribed systemic antimicrobial therapy form.
Comments or concerns from the committee? I think there's agreement that we go back to the original name, and that was, is there anything else that we can find in the steering committee recommendations? Have we gone back notes?
Yeah, that was the only condition that you had.
Okay, thank you. So it sounds like we'll be appropriately do a 180 degree and we'll go back to the original, and that's what people are comfortable with.
It probably won't be the last time, right, John?
I think the developers bring up a good point. All right, well, thank you. Let's go to number 43.
And the reviewers for that were Dr. Adams and Dr. O'Connor.
Jim, have you had a chance to look at this?
I have. I guess the question is if we have an exclusion that the clinicians who are not credentialed don't have to do this, then we've kind of undermined the intent, I think, of the measure. And so the question is it time for a standard that IJ central lines have to be done under ultrasound guidance? And I thought that was the conversation that we had. But it would be a big change for the industry. That means a lot of EDs have to get ultrasounds in their departments that don't have it. So maybe it's a little step too far, and the exclusion is good. So I would open it up. I don't have strong feelings about that exclusion, but that was the question that I had.
This is Suzanne. I had in my notes that we just wanted clarification about their credentialing, like
right. Mm-hmm.
To add that statement in, not necessarily stating that we shall only put in central lines under ultrasound guidance.
Okay.
Not that I don't think that's coming in the future. I do.
Right.
But at this point, I thought that really our comment back was just around the credentialing aspect.
This is Angela, representing the measure developer, and we did have the same kind of conversation about, you know, pushing the envelope, but we just felt that we were responding to some comments on the panel that safety was a concern about people who were not, or physicians who were not credentialed in this particular mm-hmm. procedure.
Well, I think a lot of that stemmed around, you know, training to perform it in this way. I think there was a lot of discussion from a member of our team, Kat, that, you know, indicated, you know, it takes appropriate training to be able to manage the insertion and the
That's right.
ultrasound, et cetera. And I think the idea was that if I'm credentialed, I'm going to be adequately trained and competent to do this. And I sort of remember that's, at least that's what I had in my notes.
So could I ask a question? The measure says the percentage of adult patients with an IJ that's placed under ultrasound. And then I don't understand, I guess, if I wasn't credentialed, I couldn't report 100%. So I'm just not sure how that works.
And yet you're qualified to do it based on our current training.
Right.
Well, I guess just for information, I would say that as ABEM has looked at this, we've taken out ultrasound for the recertification, as it were, exam, because when we studied the current practice, there was less than 50%, 40% of physicians were using it.
Mm-hmm.
It is part of the initial certification because residents are being taught this, and so we have, for example, questions on the initial exam regarding ultrasound, but not in the recertification because of the current state of practice. So I would just, as that ties into this a little bit, I mean, if you're not, if more than 50% of our physicians aren't using this, aren't credentialed, what does that mean in terms of this guideline? I thought we were saying that that it would be an exclusion if you weren't credentialed, but I guess we've got to clarify this
right.
Summer.
I think that's correct.
That's correct.
So if you're not credentialed, then you're not included in this.
You would fall out of the mix.
So this would only apply then to physicians who have current credentialing. So does that?
That was our intent as developers.
Okay.
So I guess that then within an institution, I'm just not sure how would we have differentiation then? Because if I was credentialed, I guess it would be 100%, and if I wasn't credentialed, I'd be excluded.
That was the intent, I believe.
It kind of said that actually almost is doing a disservice to those who are credentialed. And I guess the other question in the setting of a training program, I'm awfully often at the bedside being that second person, but I'm not the person performing the procedure who is not credentialed but is working on getting credentialed. And that's almost universal in an academic institution.
Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, if I have a senior resident who's actually doing the insertion, and I may be at the bedside either performing the ultrasound guidance or supervising the procedure, would that qualify as a credentialed person actually doing the insertion?
I think it would. I think you're responsible for that procedure. That'd be my thought. I don't know what other people think.
I can speak from the hospital side. You would have to be credentialed to assist or help supervise someone to do it.
I think the question was, if you were credentialed and you were supervising it, would that qualify here? I would think it would, Suzanne. Is that?
Yeah, I would agree, yes.
Okay.
And Angela, you're there, right?
Yes, I am.
So is that your interpretation of this as well?
Yes, and our discussion was that the hospital would have their own credentialing process, so we didn't want to get down to that level with the measure.
Okay.
If that's, I'm not sure about what hospital procedures would be credentialing.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it just seems to me there's an incentive not to credential now.
Right.
This is Karen Pace, and I guess the question this discussion brings up for me is, what does the evidence say should be done? Should all of these be done under ultrasound guidance? So then why would you exclude any of them?
Well, I think this is my interpretation is that we're in evolution here. I mean, 2 years ago, we would probably not have had this conversation. Now it's becoming much more practice, both in terms of training, both included, both in scope of practice and training. But we're not there yet, and either ultrasounds aren't available or physicians haven't been trained specifically in this use. And we envision this will become, and we're training our residents to do this, so it will become practice. It's just not available to everyone, and not everyone has been credentialed. It's an evolutionary process, so we're kind of in the middle here a little bit.
Right, and the measure was intended to show that this is, there's a lot of strong evidence that this is a safer way to perform some of these procedures and to encourage credentialing. That was the intent behind the development of the measure.
Right. Yeah. So it just seems like if the evidence is strong that that should be done, that's how the measure should be, and recognizing that the performance on it in the current environment may not be great across the board, and that's the reason that we are interested in quality performance measures.
Right.
So I'm not sure about adjusting a measure because people aren't doing a practice that evidence shows should be done.
Yeah, I'm just, this is Bob O'Connor here. I'm just thinking of the residents that we train. If they start an IJ, they almost 100% of the time use ultrasound. In fact, it is 100%. I think if we're careful defining just that specific line, which I think the measure does, I'm perfectly comfortable with saying that ultrasound be done. If a clinician is not credentialed for ultrasound guidance, they're probably going to put a line in by some other method or some other location, right?
Well, I guess that's the question that's being asked.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe this on the reporting issue. If I'm not credentialed and not using ultrasound but putting in IJs, what do my data look like? And would I report that I'm not sure, 100%? It just seems like a confusing thing to me. Or all excluded, so I have no data to enter. And if there's all excluded, no data to enter, that makes a little bit of sense to me. So then I would think that would be a fine measure as written.
So you're okay with this? This would be a measure, a recommended measure, but those who aren't credentialed then would be excluded, would not report.
Yeah, and then they would say, like, not applicable, zero to report.
But
actually,
we're trying to provide an incentive for those physicians to get credentialed and do it this way.
Yeah. And so then start reporting their percents. And then so everybody that reports probably would be 100% and everybody else would be reporting nothing. Yeah, I guess that is an incentive to get credentialed then.
Which is?
The measure as written, because if I'm submitting nothing to report and it's all not applicable, eventually that will become apparent that I should have something.
So you think having it this way will provide an incentive for emergency physicians to get credentialed so they can report this measure?
Yeah, I think because I'm interpreting it properly now that if I have nothing in that measure, I can stay under the radar for a while, but eventually other centers are going to be reporting 100%, and I'm not going to be able to stay not applicable or zero for too long. So my interpretation is correct. If it's incorrect, I support this measure then.
Other comments from the committee?
This is Ed again. So I kind of vaguely remember this in the discussion. Was this continuous ultrasound guidance or IJ localization followed by insertion?
Yeah, no, that was the point of the credentialing, that
right.
If you have to have credentials so that you've proven that you're doing it right with the continuous ultrasound guidance.
That's right.
And so for small hospital, I mean, so for single practitioner locations, you need to be able to do this
Right.
Without any other assistance.
Right. Other than a nurse, perhaps, but that's right.
So I guess the question for the group is, does the exclusion provide the incentive here, or does it take away from the incentive? I guess it promotes safety, which is what I heard as part of the discussion. If we don't have the exclusion in, we're promoting it for people who aren't trained to do it, and that's not a safe thing to do. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is Helen. That's my recollection of the discussion as well, where there was really concerns about people without training using the technique as a safety concern.
Right.
Have we gone around? Are people comfortable then with recommending this?
I think so.
Yeah, now that I think since it's Bob here.
I'm sorry, Bob, you cut out, or I didn't hear you. You're okay?
Yes, I am.
Well, it sounds like we're good with number 43. All right. Well, moving right along, that took us a good half an hour. Candidate measures pending recommendations. So we're going to number 8.
Yes, and Dr. Beverly Collins reviewed this measure.
Thank you.
Okay. I looked at our concerns that we had last time. One was adding some specification to the measures related to the patient age. We had concerns because the evidence that was promoted in the submission by the measure developer was that most children that develop otitis media with effusion are less than 4 years of age, but the measure includes those children up to age 12, so we asked for some more description and justification for that. And the measure developer just said that they thought they clearly articulated the concerns were in their original submission. So I don't think they answered our concerns there at all. The next thing that we had concerns about was some of the data, where it comes from, the sources, and we had questions about what they meant by special or unique data. And they clarified that to mean hybrid data, a mixture of electronic data collection and medical records. So they did address that. We wanted more information about the care setting, where the testing would take place, and I didn't see any addressing of that in this recent submission. As far as the future of the validity testing, they just said that they're going to test it, do some field testing, and that was in, in compliance with these time-limited measures for NQF, so no further really insight into that. They did not address the comparability of multiple data sources and feasibility. That was something that was missed or not addressed in the original submission, nor in this one. And then we asked for some more specifics on the number of children with otitis media and effusion, and the extent of hearing testing is a routine at this point in time. They did state that about 50% of children experience otitis media, and increases by about 60% by age 2, and there was a hearing loss, and they said what the average hearing loss is, but really didn't address how many children do experience hearing loss with the otitis media and effusion. And we also want to know how many currently get hearing tests, and that was not addressed. So I think those other concerns we have were not addressed either. So I don't think that the new evidence that they gave us really adds anything to the support of the importance of the test or the gap that exists that may or may not exist in the testing at this point in time.
Thank you. Is there anyone here from AMA?
Yeah, hi, this is Sam Tierney with the AMA PCPA. Unfortunately, Dr. Rosenfeld had to sign off. And I apologize that there wasn't additional information related to some of the concerns that you identified. We were trying to respond to those specific items that were identified in the document that we received, the letter requesting additional clarification, and unfortunately some of those items did not specifically state some of the concerns that you just identified. But if I may, I could just address a few of the points. The This measure is based on a guideline recommendation that recommends hearing testing for persistent OME or at any time that language delay, learning problems, or a significant hearing loss is suspected in a child with OME. The guideline is specific to children aged 2 months through 12 years, and so that is why the age range is defined as such in the measure. There is additional information in the guideline related to the type of testing that would be required for children aged 4 years or older, and that testing based on age, testing should vary based on age. However, the testing is recommended for all children aged 2 months through 12 years, and as a result, our denominator is specified as such. We also have a little additional information related to the gaps, and I apologize that this wasn't included in the response that we provided to you. There was a survey that was done that identified, I'm just looking for my notes, that identified that only 33%, it was a study that compared different practice patterns based on specialty, and it identified that only 33% of pediatricians, 14% of otolaryngologists, and 40.5% of pediatric otolaryngologists correctly identified that the correct next step after 4 months of persistent OME is a hearing threshold evaluation or a hearing test. So although that is just one study that was conducted, it is the available information out there related to the gap, and it does indicate a sense that there is a considerable opportunity for improvement in this area. So I know that only addresses a few of the additional things that you mentioned, but I wanted to share that for your consideration.
Okay, thank you. Beverly?
Yeah, my concern with the comments that she just made was that even though the guidelines say that it goes up to age 12, well, what's behind that? I mean, it still hasn't addressed why, if most kids get the disease or the condition at age 4, why continue it up to age 12? So if it's in the guidelines somewhere, that information should be presented to us. As far as the latter part about the testing, that was just a testing of knowledge of practitioners and what they believe, compliance with the guidelines or whatever, but it doesn't really address what goes on in the real world. So what is the actual rate of hearing tests in people and children with otitis media with effusion? So I think we don't really know what the gap is still.
Sounds like you don't believe we have enough information to move ahead with a recommendation.
No, that's my opinion.
Comments from the other committee members? All right. Well, anything else on number 8?
No.
All right. We have agreement there. Let's move on to number 19. This is time to phone, and I think Suzanne, you were on this.
Yes.
Sorry, I don't.
And Dr. Cohen isn't here today, so I think you're it today.
I'm it today. Okay. I think that we. The median time to troponin, we recommended that it really be focused, that there were so many measures already endorsed and focused on chest pain or acute MI that we really thought that this measure would probably be better if it was scoped to the going back to my notes here, just give me a second.
I thought it should be limited to patients with non-traumatic, first
That's
of all.
That's right, non-traumatic chest pain. Change the title from median time of troponin results to time troponin ordered as opposed for non-traumatic chest pain. Is optimal on the call still?
Yes, I am, and I'll be happy. So the committee made three recommendations, which we made all three changes. The first was to limit the denominator population to those patients who present with non-traumatic chest pain, or AMI, which we did. second was, rather than using time the test is ordered until the test was done, to use time of arrival until test was done. And then the third was change the title of the measure itself, which we did do. The final thing, again, here the committee recommended moving away from a time of central tendency or a measure of central tendency, and we suggested that for non-traumatic chest pains with a troponin done, we would look at the proportion completed within 60 minutes. So I think we made all the changes the committee recommended.
Yes.
I think that's an important change, and I think that that will provide very useful data.
I would concur.
The only question I had, but this will still require, Suzanne, abstraction from those doing point of care troponins, is that correct?
I think it, well, I think it would depend on your point of care, if that is, well, you'll have arrival time because you have that for everyone else. You'll have resulted. It will depend on whether you have integration between your point of care modalities with your results reporting in your laboratory and whether that can be automated or whether you'll have to do that manually.
Do others have any thoughts about that?
Although I would say you might have the same thing with arrival time.
All right, well, seems like we had some recommendations. They've all been done. Suzanne, are you comfortable with this?
I actually am. I think they've done a good job.
Any other thoughts from the committee? Sounds like we're good with this one. All right, thank you. Number 35, patients with an EM visit for syncope that had, oh, these are the previous ones that we deferred looking for AMA data harmonization. Is that correct?
Yes. And Dr. Giles is on the first one. This is the EKG with the syncope. And the second one is Dr. O'Connor, the ECG for the non-traumatic chest pain. We haven't heard back. I don't know if anyone from AMA can speak to the data that you have so far, if you have any. I didn't hear anything back with regards to this specific issue.
Hi, this is Greg Wozniak at the AMA-PCPI. We provided test results that we had available for the two measures that you cited. And beyond that, I'm not quite sure what input you were looking for us in terms of efforts to harmonize with the Ingenix measures.
Actually, I didn't get those. I only got them for measures, the ENT measures, and, yeah, those were the only ones. And I think the ENT, the 21, the assessment, the diagnostic evaluation assessment. So there may have been some miscommunication or maybe it got lost, but if we could have those, again, that would be great. I don't know if you have my email.
So these, again, just for clarity, these are the two emergency medicine EKG measures?
With
syncope? Yes.
Okay. I guess we may have miscommunicated or something, but I was looking at what I thought we had sent you, but we can get those to you.
Okay.
Well, it sounds like the committee doesn't have this information right now, it seems.
That's correct.
Zed
Yalkin, I've not seen any information subsequent to our meeting.
So we would.
As soon as I get the information from AMA, I will forward it on to the committee. It looks like we probably have to have a shorter version of this call to go over those measures, but also perhaps if we don't get through the remaining three measures, we may have to discuss those too.
So we're deferring on 35 and 36.
Okay.
And we go back to number 10.
And these are measures that the committee did not recommend for endorsement, but the measure stewards have requested reconsideration. And number
10, I think it was Jeff.
Yep.
And Tanya, is Tanya?
Again, for me, I think that one of the things we discussed is that there are so many measurements for pain that are already instituted at several different locations and per policy that adding one for a specific illness condition, ocutotitis externa, might be redundant, although I agree that with their concept that people aren't always addressing this and that they were more concerned about the non-emergency setting, including what they call the urgent and outpatient care settings. But again, I still don't think it I don't think it changes our discussion any.
Is there anyone from AMA who can talk to this?
This is Sam Tierney again. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the person who just spoke, but I think you certainly understood our sense for requesting the reconsideration and that, you know, this measure is four settings beyond the emergency department, which, as you had all agreed, there are a number of pain instruments, tools out there that are already being used in the emergency department setting. I think we just wanted you to consider that this measure also relates to other settings, particularly the urgent outpatient care setting, and that the PQRI data from this measure does show that there's a significant opportunity for improvement on that is in the outpatient care setting.
Jeff, are you, you'd be more comfortable with this almost if it excluded the ED?
Yes, this is Jeff Collins. Yes, I think that would be fine. I think one of the issues that came up was tying this into, you know, bundling this with some of the other ocutotitis externa measures and, you know, whether we would look at it with the assessment of tympanatic membrane mobility or something else. But, you know, again, all most urgent cares and outpatient and ambulatory care centers are credentialed by somebody, and this outside credentialing always has pain as a standard. And so, you know, whether you're freestanding or not, I think you still have to assess pain. And so, again, you know, having a specific pain measurement for a specific condition, I think, is still redundant and doesn't get us very far.
Yeah.
Is there anyone who wants to change our recommendation? I think we just felt this wasn't appropriate as a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not hearing support for changing it, so I think we can move ahead. So we'll go to number 14, assessment of tympanic membrane mobility. Remember this discussion?
Yes.
Beverly, this was yours.
That was mine. The concerns we had about this one were the same as the other one about the hearing testing, again with the ages, saying that the children that have the otitis media with effusion are less than 4 years of age usually, but the measure goes up to those with age 12. For testing for a tympanic membrane mobility. Our big concern was that most people felt that with adequate visual examination, most people could make the diagnosis, and we really didn't need to test the mobility of the membrane, especially since the equipment used to do that are pretty much missing in practice at this point in time. The measure developer came back and, again, just reiterated the importance of being able to determine membrane mobility. And then they addressed some survey data, again, showing that maybe most of the respondents didn't know the appropriate test to use according to their guidelines. But I don't think that there was any new information that was added that would make us change our position.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone on the committee who wants to change our recommendation? From the AMA, do you want to speak to this?
No, thanks. I have nothing else to add.
you. Sounds like we move ahead with our original recommendation, and we move to number 21.
Yes.
Time from head CT to interpretability. And let's see, who was on this one?
It was Dr. Jouse and Dr. Roberts.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, hi, so this is Ed Jouse. So I think, not to jump in, but I think, you know, some of our concerns before were both the scope, the breadth of the scope in terms of the patients who would be captured by this metric, but also some of the technical issues as to how this information would be recorded and the amount of chart review that would be required. So the CMS, who apparently is one of the proponents of this, came back with a more refined and targeted measure, as you can see there, to now specifically look at the proportion of stroke and TIA patients with acute onset of symptoms or last well known within 2 hours who have a CT brain interpreted within 45 minutes of arrival. And I guess the rationale for this was that CMS strongly suggested the submission of this revised measure. It is consistent with what we had come up with at a NINS symposium some years back, saying that we think 45 minutes would be reasonable. But I can tell you, as being one of the participants in that, it was not based on any set of data, but rather what we just felt would be reasonable. It is something that is captured to a certain extent in terms of the Get With The Guidelines and some of the Joint Commission measures. So it's, at least the onset time is going to be fairly well known for these patients. Although I will say that some of the TIAs, that's not always the case. And then the interpretation was more clearly defined as the time the scan is read by any qualified clinician. So I think this is a step in the right direction and clearly focuses on a disease state that is very relevant to some of the other concomitant measures. I guess my issues with this, and I'll just put them out there, and I don't know if Catherine or Kat is on the call or not because I know she has the flu. But, you know, oftentimes if we have a patient who presents with a TIA and they have a pretty good clear-cut story and yet they're clinically back to normal, the next step for us is getting an emergent MRI, and they never go to the CT scan because even in the setting of a negative CT scan, we use the MRI to make some of our decision-making processes. So, you know, we may unfairly punish by reporting numbers of TIA patients who do not get a CAT scan and yet actually get a more definitive test in a timely fashion. You know, 2 hours is important, although with our current recommendations going out to 4.5 for IV TPA and going out to 8 hours for some of our intra-arterial strategies as recommended by the American Heart and others, the 2 hours is you know, an important population, but not the entire population. And I guess the last thing that I think, and this relates to not only on-sites where you have a stroke team responding, but also in those with telemedicine, is that I'm often at the console, or my stroke expert is at the console, the CT scan, and doing the interpretation. That's the one that makes the most importance in terms of patient therapy selections, and not the attending read or the resident read in particular, which may come at a later date. And that's, having been on call for this entire weekend for telemedicine, you know, I'm making a treatment decision based on what I see by telemedicine, not by what is read down the road. So I guess my question is, it's difficult to capture when it's not just the qualified clinician, but it's the treating clinician or the, you know, it's both qualified and the treating clinician is read. If it's a radiologist, it's fairly easy to capture that information because of the timestamp on the interpretation or the wet read. If it is not the radiologist or if it's a verbal wet read from them, it's harder to capture that information. So I think it's a step in the right direction. I'm still a little concerned about the scope as well as the feasibility.
So this is Dale with Optimal. I just wanted to address two issues that you did raise. The first one was the data elements actually address that issue of the TIA. If the patient doesn't have a CT, they're actually not in the denominator of the measure. They're excluded. And second issue I wanted to address, the interpretation, the way we defined that was the earliest interpretation, which the hospital could define. So if you sat there at the machine and did an interpretation, then the hospital could record that time, though you are correct that sometimes that's a more difficult time to find from electronic sources. But the date element does specify the earliest time interpreted.
Ed, does that help?
It does. It does. You know, and I guess it'll be interesting. Cause, I mean, we're going to have to. I mean, I would look to see how we'd implement this here as part of our stroke team, and it's, you know, I can tell you, like, at night when I'm on call and a resident may be here, I may look at it from home, and I'm just going to try to have to figure out a way that we're going to need to capture some of that information when I'm looking at it using the PAC system. Because I just look at it. It's a very passive one-way stream of information. I don't make any comments on it, and yet I'll be at home talking to the resident, looking at the CT scan with a neurology resident, and you know, it's my interpretation, or at least my impression at that point, that will largely be guiding what the resident's going to do, and not the one that will come later from the radiology resident looking at the scan. So it's going to challenge some sites that actually get a lot of stroke patients. To find ways to capture data that are not currently being clearly caught or placed into the medical record.
I believe our second reviewer is also on the line, who's a neurologist. Do you want to share anything, Dr. Carlo Poma? Actually, Helen, he is not. He couldn't make it today. Bummer. Okay.
I think we also, the other thing we tried to do, Helen, thanks for all the information, we did try to address all of the concerns of the committee from a couple of years ago that actually had dealt with this. The reason, the other comment you made was the two-hour issue before arrival. We decided to align with the Joint Commission stroke measures that are already in QFORS, which use that data element, last known well, which uses the two-hour time frame. So.
Okay.
So that's we were aligning with other measure sets that are already in QF endorsed.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm just not aware of all the other NQF measures that have been endorsed related to this particular disease or test performance.
My understanding of what we're seeing is that all the patients who had symptoms within 2 hours who had a CT would be the denominator, and the numerator would be less than interpretation done within first interpretation within 45 minutes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Ed, do you have a recommendation?
It's kind of like our previous discussion. Sometimes, you know, we have to start with one and see how it's how it works, if you will. So I'm much happier with the scope and in terms of a disease-specific entity. And like you said, there is some harmonization that occurs with the Joint Commission and get with the guidelines recommendations. So I would probably recommend to accept it as it currently reads.
And this is Helen. Just one thought might be, since we're going to have to send you information anyway on the other two harmonization concerns between the PCPI and the NGENX measures, perhaps we'll get the second reviewer to weigh in and share that with you along with the harmonization concerns. We'll also share with you the exact Joint Commission measure that Dale is referring to, just so you could see it all put together, and we can, I think, do that discussion on email.
That would be very helpful.
That'd be helpful.
Is that okay with you, John and Suzanne? Okay.
Great. So I think that's the, at this point, we need to open our discussion for any public comments. Are there any?
I'm not sure if the operator's on, if she could open up the line. If there's any.
I think this is a it's not assisted by an operator.
Okay, so it's just all open. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
So it sounds like our next steps will be some additional information on the CT one, on the two EKG ones. We will have to have a short conference call to consider the two EKG measures. Is that correct?
It all depends. I mean, I think if we can package it well enough for you, you might be able to just handle it on email. I realize schedules are difficult for a second call. We'll get a read from you on that as we package it.
So we will await to see that before then the actual vote on all of these.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Helen, do you think we should just proceed with the vote after this meeting on the measures that have been agreed upon and then go back to the ones that are pending, the ECG and the...
I think if we can, it would be helpful to get these out as soon as we can while this is in our minds.
Right, exactly. So maybe we, I'll talk with Lisa after the call. Maybe we'll just package everything we can with the exception of these final three measures, get it out to you, and then send you a follow-up email about the remaining three. Because I do think it would be very helpful to have a neurologist's perspective on the CT scan measure.
And actually, I think it would be even more important to have the radiology because that's going to be the community.
Oh, that's right. And CAT as well, certainly, yes. We'll make sure both of them have a chance to weigh in and get and send that back to you on email with their comments. And if you want to call for those final three measures, we're more than happy to set up just a short, you know, 45-minute call or something to go over those.
Well, if we can send it out to the group so that people can respond, if anyone wants to have a call, then we can do it. And if people are comfortable, then we'll just move ahead. So,
yep.
Is that acceptable to the committee?
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Well, I think we're at the end. I appreciate everyone's time. This is good to get through all this.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Okay, see you all. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Oh, it went off.
Okay.